Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Ann Strainchamps. Imagine being punched in the stomach in gym class for wearing sneakers that look different from the ones your classmates are wearing. Or how about the time three older classmates dragged me into a high school washroom, pulled my legs out from under me, and my head bounced off of the cold tile floor? These things happen to me, and I know I'm not alone. You probably have similar stories. I got off easy. I knew I'd be okay as soon as the school day ended, safe at home. These days, even home isn't safe. Kids have to deal with the relentless onslaught of 24/7 cyberbullying. All bullying, all the time. Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, we explore the bullying epidemic. Have we reached peak bullying? Is there anything that we can do to stop it? And we'll explore the idea that bullying starts at the top because it's baked into the DNA of America's huge corporations and the military. I can't tell you how much I've thought about what I'd say to my childhood bullies if I ran into them today. If you've ever been bullied, you've probably had similar revenge fantasies, but you probably haven't taken it to the extreme that Alan Kurzweil has. He actually tracked down his childhood bully. Kurzweil is a novelist. He writes about the experience in a book called Whipping Boy: The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully. Kurzweil's story starts at a boarding school in Switzerland named Eglon. He's a 10-year-old Jewish kid, and his bully is named Caesar Augustus.
In winter of 1971, there was a musical that had an international celebrity, Jesus Christ Superstar. And perhaps because of his name, perhaps because of my religious identity, whatever the reason, Caesar channeled his Baroque capacities for humiliation into a theatrical event at the top floor of our room. He reproduced one of the songs from Jesus Christ Superstar, The 39 Lashes, along with his henchmen. I remember vividly tying me up and whipping me to a soundtrack that was simply the enumeration of whipping from 1 to 39.
1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7, 8.
At each interval, the listener hears the sound, the crack of the whip. But Caesar, true to fashion, actually put his own personal spin on that number, in that he didn't always lay the belt against my back when he was pantomiming this song. He took as much, if not greater, pleasure in acting as if he were about to whip me, pausing and stopping. And I can remember more vividly than just about anything else, this grimace, this kind of rictus of pleasure that spread over his lips as he watched me flinch in anticipation of a belt that did not, in fact, make contact.
Ooh, that sounds really traumatizing. He's got his henchmen there, and then there are other kids, and I guess they're laughing.
Yeah, there was all of that. There was the humiliation that comes with a bunch of boys watching you suffer. But I don't think that was the defining and propelling moment of my relationship with Caesar. I think that is tethered to his connection to the loss, theft, disappearance of an extremely important object that I had taken with me from home as a sort of talisman and security blanket. And that object was my father's wristwatch.
Hmm.
My father died when I was 5. My father was a Viennese emigre, a brilliant inventor and engineer. Hmm. And when he passed away, I inherited very few things from him. But the one that I cherished most was an Omega Seamaster wristwatch. This was my totem. This was my talisman. And this was my rosebud. And I can still resurrect the sense of panic when I discovered that the watch was gone. I was completely gutted by the terror of sudden awareness that this timepiece, this connection to my dad, was missing. And I instantly suspected some dorm room conspiracy, immediately presumed that Caesar was somehow implicated in the disappearance.
Hmm.
It took me a couple of days to find out what happened. Eventually, it surfaced that not Caesar, but his sidekick, was convinced to launch the watch into the snow. that's what happened, or at least that's what I was told happened, and the watch was never recovered.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. So you leave the Swiss boarding school and you move on to the next phase of your life. You get married and you and your wife Françoise are in your mid-20s and you're living in Paris. Can you tell me about that?
We played hooky from our respective projects one day and decided to take a walk through the Louvre. As we were going through the Louvre, I was stopped dead in my tracks in front of this gray silk screen scene of a flagellation. I found myself looking at this scene of Christ strapped to a cross being whipped. And Françoise knew enough of the story of Switzerland to say, ah oui, le César. It was Caesar, wasn't it, that you're thinking of?
Hmm.
I said, yeah, I am thinking about him. She asked me, do you ever wonder what happened to him? And I said, sure, you know, quite often. So she said, well, why don't you find out?
Aha. So you start doing some research. Fast forward several years and we have the internet. That must have made it that much easier for you to track down Caesar.
About 0.63 seconds after I typed in his rather distinguished name, Caesar Augustus Viana III, I got a hit.
Hmm.
The first hit that I got informed me that Caesar Augustus Viana was a professor of chemistry and a philanthropist. And I have to say, I was profoundly disappointed at this news. It didn't seem right. But to my considerable relief, further digging revealed that, in fact, the Caesar Augustus in question was not my roommate, but a man 10 years our senior.
Okay.
So that was a false positive, and then there was another one. But eventually, I never thought I would ever say this, but God bless the New York Post. It had an article about a quartet of swindlers who claimed to be the Prince of Serbia and his retinue. And the four of them managed to fleece a bunch of New York entrepreneurs out of millions of dollars. And the roper in this whole scheme was a man named Caesar Augustus.
So now you've tracked down Caesar and you meet with him. Tell me about that, about meeting with him.
It was terrifying. It shouldn't have been terrifying. I dragged my feet for more than a year before I screwed up the courage to actually fly out to California. He had been released from prison. And it was only because my editor pushed me that I actually screwed up the courage to confront my childhood nemesis. I dragged my feet because I didn't want to confront the 12-year-old. In fact, I met him a couple of times and managed to tease out his version of what had happened as far as his prosecution, his unfair prosecution. He, to this day, insists that he's completely innocent of any criminal activity, and that he would never hurt anybody. But in any case, eventually, I did confront him and reveal that the motive force behind my inquiry was the things that he had done to me when I was 10.
So the first time you met with Caesar, did he remember you?
He did not. In fact, he insisted that we never even roomed together.
Huh.
This kind of amnesia was actually not restricted to me. Facebook at the time had a couple of people who also recalled their run-ins with Caesar. And when I mentioned a couple of the postings and the names of the boys who had recalled his misbehaviors, he said, I have no idea who that person is. The book came out actually after an article in The New Yorker appeared. When the article, also called Whipping Boy, appeared in The New Yorker, I received thousands of responses, including three boys, or at the time boys, whom I did not know at the time, who sent letters of thanks to say that they too had been tormented by Caesar. And I met a few of them subsequently, and they filled out my memories with memories of their own.
Hmm. Did Caesar ever apologize to you?
He left a rather compelling voicemail on my phone.
Important apologize to you for whatever I may have caused. And I'm sorry about that. I really didn't realize until you told me that you've been looking for me since 91 that I, you know, how important this is for you. And I fully respect that, and I know how it feels. As I've told you, I'm still dealing with it to this day from time to time.
But he did not go so far as to acknowledge that, in fact, he had done any of the things that I say, that I recalled having done. He then rescinded that apology, in a manner of speaking.
So your story raises a couple of bigger questions. Can people really change? And if they can, do we really want them to? What do you think?
I think people can change, absolutely. I think people can heal. I believe I've transcended the shame and the anguish and the pain of that childhood experience. That's not to say I don't have the scars, but I prefer to see them as badges rather than marks of shame. So I do think that I am stronger. The bullying turned out to be a blessing in many ways, an opportunity to bring me closer to my family, closer to my father. So I think I see dividends and benefits actually having emerged out of all of these painful experiences.
Alan Kurzweil is the author of Whipping Boy, The 40-Year Search for My 12-Year-Old Bully. Bullying's changed a lot since Kurzweil's time. For one thing, he didn't have to deal with cyberbullying. Kids now have the technology to bully other kids outside of school, on evenings and weekends. As many as 25% of teenagers have been the victims of cyberbullying, according to one study. And those teens are most likely to say they've thought of suicide. Emily Bazelon has spent a lot of time studying cyberbullying. She's the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Charles Monroe Kane sat down to talk with her.
I remember it being like, it's a physical thing. Some kid, normally a boy, would like, you know, punch you or, you know, take your money. And then it kind of transformed a little bit. But now my kids are like, well, if somebody hits you, that's not a big deal, my son said. I said, what is a big deal? I said, well, if somebody emails you something mean because other people can read it and it really hurts your feelings. And they're much more aware of that kind of bullying. And it's really a big deal. I would say 4 or 5 times this year there were bullying little conferences at school where all the school would meet to get a little anti-bullying pencil, and it was all about words. Is that what you're talking about, that we've transformed to, kind of evolved to bullying being words and not being physical?
I think that's right. I mean, it's important to remember that words can have pretty devastating psychological consequences.
Yeah.
And so if you think about bullying as harassment, whether it's verbal or physical, that continues over time and involves a power imbalance. That's one way of limiting what we're talking about and limiting the kind of behavior involved in bullying to what kids have described as finding the most upsetting. And then you can see that, yeah, words are a way in which to have power over someone over a long period of time, or, you know, a period of time, in a way that can really, really get to them.
What do you say to my mom and dad, or your mom and dad, who are like, ah, come on, that's not bullying, you know, that's just, you know, kids need to toughen up. I mean, geez, just some mean words. That generation above us does not get the level of what cyberbullying and what it means. How do you argue with those folks?
Well, I think when you talk to kids about their experiences of cyberbullying, if they've been a victim of it, it's clear what's so hard about it, right? First of all, it feels very 24/7 to them. So when I was in 8th grade and having just like a miserable time of it and feeling like a victim of bullying, I would go home at the end of the day and I had a break and I didn't have this awareness hanging over me. The kids could still be talking about me, still writing mean stuff that would then be permanent and visible to anyone who looked at it on the internet. That can really have a kind of psychologically corrosive effect on kids. That's quite damaging. And I don't think that, you know, blowing it off and telling kids to toughen up is really going to, you know, help them address those issues.
Do kids see this as real? Like, I know, I'm, and maybe because they're younger, they do. But, you know, I think people don't see the internet as real as the real world. So, like, hey, I can call her this or call him that on the internet because it isn't really real. But I think you argue that it's more real, right?
Well, it's funny. It's both, I think. So I think sometimes kids who are drawn into bullying online because of the distancing, because they're not looking another person in the face, they forget that it's real. And they sometimes try on a kind of meaner, strutting persona that they would probably never do in person. So one thing that I found really worrisome when I was working on my book were posts saying to a kid, you know, one kid saying to another kid, why don't you just go kill yourself?
Wow.
It's really hard, right? Like, that's awful.
You would never say that on the playground. Or maybe you would, but I doubt if you'd say that on the playground, right?
I think that's right. I think you would never say that in person to someone's face. But if you can say it anonymously online, somehow I think you're right. You forget that those words still can have an impact. But the person receiving the message, it can feel all too real, right? Because they have this feeling that often anyone can read the names they've been called, the insults being hurled at them. There's no way to control the audience. It's not ephemeral. It's not like the spoken word where it happens, it's over. You can go back and keep obsessing about it and looking at it. And you have to decide whether to respond or not over a period of time. All of those things, again, can have really tricky, complicated psychological consequences for some kids.
Well, let's be specific. I would assume probably the most commonplace, and it certainly is for my life and for young people, is on Facebook. And Facebook does stay, in some ways, forever. Is cyberbullying, that must be a serious issue for Facebook.
It is an issue for Facebook, and also even more important for kids right now, Instagram, which
right.
Facebook owns, and Snapchat, separate company, because Instagram and Snapchat are where kids do more of their socializing. And most of these sites have rules against harassment. Some of them go as far as saying things like offensive speech. But then there's the problem of enforcement. There are just so many millions of posts and bytes of information zinging along these sites. What really happens if you report it? What do the site see as bullying and harassment as opposed to how you experience it? And what do we want from these places? Are they places that we want to think of as having these private enforcers, essentially like a speech code? Or do we want them to not really be exercising control?
I'm wondering, you know, if I put the F word on Facebook, it could be very likely I get an issue back from a person from Facebook telling me, hey, you can't do that, or they, you know, block your post. Do they do the same for bullying or that kind of language? That must be much trickier. You know, an algorithm can figure out if you're swearing, but it's hard to know if you're being mean or not.
Right. Well, that's certainly what the sites have claimed. They have said it's hard for us to come up with an algorithm. There are so many subjective connotations that go into how people experience words. It's just too hard for us to figure out in advance. We need people to report to us what bullying is, and then we'll judge it. And so that's the sort of trade-off that these sites have been making. And I think the consumers have not really, you know, en masse demanded all that much enforcement from Facebook or Twitter or Instagram.
My understanding is that if you say, Emily, if you say something about me on Facebook that I don't like, I can report you. And if I report you, there's a team, and that team comes to me. And I mean, isn't that how it works? But that could be almost, I could see that being abused as well.
Well, right. So then that team has to decide. And when I was reporting my book a couple years ago, they were making very split-second decisions about what counted as bullying and harassment and what didn't. And then they had to decide what the consequence was going to be. And all of this was happening very, very quickly. And with millions of different users in different countries, if Facebook really took this seriously, it would take a lot of manpower to really address it. And so Facebook was trying instead to create automated responses that would encourage kids to go find someone in their community to go and help with this and talk about it and hopefully work out the conflict. And, you know, you can see the reason for that. Those people are going to know the context. They're going to have some understanding. And then you can also see why it's in Facebook's self-interest not to have to really step in and mediate all of these different conflicts. That's Facebook would have to spend a lot of money if it was really going to undertake that role.
Well, it seems like probably the most, not easiest, but the simplest way to prevent bullying is to not have it start in the first place. And that would be with what you write about, which is empathy. How can we help create empathy among our children?
Right. So let's think about the word empathy for a little bit. We use it to talk about caring about other people, and I think that's really the key. It's not just that you can feel someone else's feelings. It's that you actually care about how they're feeling, and you're not using your sense of their experience to manipulate them. You're using it to try to help them in some way. So once you start thinking about empathy in that way, I think that turning to stories, to books, to movies, to videos, to try to have kids feel empathy for characters who are different from them but aren't in their real lives, that can be a really excellent place to start. It just like sort of displaces the whole anxiety around this a little if you're not asking kids to focus in on their own world and their own social lives. And often kids who can seem pretty mean, if you give them a book in which there's a really vulnerable character, you can get them to talk about that kid's vulnerabilities and how they might be able to help. And hopefully some of that thinking will then translate, perhaps unknowingly, into their own lives.
Emily Bazelon is the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane. Coming up, we'll meet two childhood archenemies who became good friends as adults. Also, is it possible that bullying is such a big problem because we're not thinking about it the right way? I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Chances are, if you were picked on as a child, I'm guessing that you don't hang out with your bully. You probably haven't patched things up. That's what makes Alex Abramovich's and Trevor Latham's friendship so remarkable. As fourth grade classmates, they were each other's arch enemies. But now they're friends. Good friends. How did that happen? Abramovich has written a book about it, Bullies, A Friendship. Raymond Tungekar sat down to talk with both Alex Abramovich and Trevor Latham.
Alex, I want to start with you. You first met Trevor in the fourth grade when you were 8 and he was 9. What do you remember about those days?
For me, that was my first year in that school, and it was my first year of living with my dad. My parents had split up earlier. So half of it is I remember, you know, this sort of series of upheavals leading into that year. I'd moved in with my dad the year previously, and we'd moved 3 times before ending up out in Trevor's town. So I remember, you know, this sort of, as I said, series of upheavals. But then I also remember Trevor, who was this sort of, you know, the brick wall that stopped my forward momentum. And I remember him as this just neighborhood bully that I ran into that would torment me daily and sort of actually erased all my other memories of that school. But I remember now when I look back on fourth grade and fifth grade and sixth grade, those years that I spent in that school, as I remember Trevor and me fighting all the time.
Trevor, I want to get your take on this. Is that pretty accurate? I mean, do you recall being Alex's bully?
Not exactly. I'd just gotten back from 2 years of being in Berkeley. And in a way, it was my old school, but in a way, I was new to it and new to living with my dad. I don't think we could have fought every single day, but it sure did feel like it. And I think it really was only 1 year, that fourth grade. After that, we were in separate classes and we didn't run into each other as much. You know, I just don't think I won all those fights. I think I might have been bigger than him, but he definitely had ferocity on me.
Yeah, and reading about these fights, they sounded pretty ferocious. I mean, how bad did it get?
I think we only got sent to the principal 2 or 3 times, so it couldn't have been that bad. But, you know, the psychological impact on it was constant. We were constantly trying to destroy each other and plotting and calling each other our arch enemies. You know, I think the physical effects weren't that bad, but just the sheer torment that we did to each other was real.
Well, and what I find fascinating is there were some good times that you remember, too. I mean, you weren't just, like, the fiercest of enemies. You occasionally hung out
together. We always called each other enemies, but at some point we were cordial with each other. And if not friends, I would never call us being friends in that grade. But we did sort of hang out because we were so similar in a weird way, you know.
Like, what would you do?
We were both the outcasts. I remember playing chess with him and cleaning erasers and just, like, being stuck in the principal's office and just kind of having to talk to each other, you know.
Do you remember any of that, Alex?
You know, it's funny. Trevor's wife, Jordan, asked me a couple of years ago if my memories were as sharp as Trevor's. And Trevor really does remember things much more clearly than I do. But Jordan asked me how much I remember. And I said, it's a funny thing. You know, when I write about something, I don't remember that thing anymore. I just remember having written about it. So I think to a certain extent, my memories are doubly warped half through the passage of time and half through writing through them. I don't remember us playing chess. I don't remember us being friends, really. I remember us fighting outside of school, which Trevor says he doesn't remember. But the sort of interesting thing I found when Trevor and I met again as adults and started comparing notes on our memories is that the memories themselves aligned pretty well. But for Trevor, like, the sort of sum total of all those experiences meant that we were friends. And for me, it meant that we'd bullied each other.
Hmm.
So I thought that was odd.
What I find fascinating, Alex, is I can imagine myself being in this position of seeing my childhood bully, just seeing an update on Facebook or something. And I think most people would see that, maybe reminisce for a little bit, maybe experience an increase in blood pressure. But ultimately, they just let it go and forget it and move on. But you didn't. You flew out to Oakland to meet Trevor. Why was that?
I don't know. Probably for the same reason that we were so tenacious when we were kids. I mean, I've never been very good at letting things go, and Trevor was my enemy, and here he was. He popped up again. So, you know, and it wasn't just that Trevor had a motorcycle club and become a biker, but I started reading about the club, and they had a fight club, an honest-to-goodness fight club.
Hmm.
And I didn't know such a thing existed outside of, you know, the Fight Club movie, but there it was. So this was, on the one hand, totally perfect, but on the other hand, even though I'm not a biker and I'm not a fighter, and now that we're fully grown, Trevor's twice my size, I thought I had this advantage of, you know, I'm a writer, and at the end of the day, I'm the one who controls the narrative this time. And all my friends, and I think all of Trevor's friends, were like, well, you have to fight each other. You have to fight each other. And I thought that was ridiculous anyway, but doubly ridiculous given the size advantage that Trevor has and the fact that I haven't actually been in a fight in 30 years and Trevor has. You know, as it happened, I flew out there and I crashed the motorcycle on my first day. And so fighting was sort of out of the question, and it became much more about talking and getting to know each other.
So you alluded to this earlier, but, you know, this motorcycle club, the East Bay Rats Motorcycle Club, they held fight nights. Can you tell me about those, Trevor?
Yeah, we started doing them way before the movie came out.
Before Fight Club came out.
Yeah. We just used to always play fight and wrestle each other. There was this kind of one table in this one kitchen, you know, in the house that we were in, and everybody would wrestle kind of every party or every time we were drinking, and eventually we threw a party around it, and every member fought another member, which I thought was normal. We were all bouncers and knuckleheads, but then other people wanted to fight, and we're still doing them.
Are there rules?
Mainly, right now, we do straight boxing rules, except that we don't have judges, so we just fight until somebody gives up, more like British bare knuckle rules. We just fight, fight, fight.
Hmm.
But they're all, you know, drunks and smokers, so it doesn't really last that long, usually.
Well, and I was kind of fascinated by the theme nights you have. Like, they're theme fights. Can you talk about some of those?
The most recent one was gentrifiers versus locals. You're a local if you've been in Oakland for over 5 years, over 10 years if you were in tech. We've done punks versus hipsters. Jews versus Gentiles.
Well, that was the first one, right, Trevor?
I think that was the first of the themed, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, Alex, what went through your mind when you witnessed your first fight?
I remember standing with Trevor up against the wall of the speakeasy and just having people going at it and blooding each other a foot in front of your face, and they would crash into you. And effectively, I mean, you are the ropes when you're standing there, or at least back then. So it was bloody, and it was, you know, violent, obviously, and it was especially bloody because the first guys I saw fight were these punk kids who had piercings in their face, and they didn't take the piercings out, so the piercings would tear, and it was you know, nasty. But it was also surprisingly not as off-putting as I thought it would be because the general atmosphere was so genial, and also because everyone was drunk, including me.
Well, and that's what I found kind of surprising. I mean, how, you know, one second these guys could just be bashing their brains out, and like in the next second, you know, they're back to being buddies again. How could that be?
Well, that sort of goes back to what I was saying is, you know, Trevor and I both remember beating each other up, but for Trevor, that was a sign of affection, and for me, that was it's the opposite. But what did you say to me, Trevor, once? I don't think I'm giving any trade secrets away because I said it in the book, but to become a member of Trevor's club, before you get patched in, you get beaten down by everyone in the club. So everyone in the club gangs up and beats you down, and there are at any given time about 35 people in the club. And when Trevor explained this process to me the first time, he said, look, there's, you know, there's blood and there's broken bones sometimes, but when else are your friends going to pay so much attention to you?
Hmm. Wow. So fighting is just another way of, like, basically showing affection or bonding.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think bonding over violence is that abnormal.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to your relationship now with Alex. I mean, would you consider yourself really good friends now?
Yeah, fully.
Okay, I want to flip that and turn that on you, Alex. Would you consider Trevor a friend?
Oh, yeah, close friends, absolutely, lifelong friends. And not just Trevor, there are other members of Trevor's club that I think at this point now are lifelong friends. We spent a lot of time together, and really, and it's not just that I got to know them, I think they really got to know me, or at least I hope they did. So, yeah, absolutely. And in a sense, the whole history of us as bullies has been erased, and now I tend to think of Trevor as my oldest friend.
Alex Abramovich is the author of Bullies, A Friendship. Raymond Tungekar talked to him and his ex-bully, Trevor Latham. How bad is bullying in the United States? These days, it seems like we're living in bully nation, doesn't it? Mind you, I'm from Canada. But still, I don't want to say America has more bullying per capita than any other country. Because if I did say that, a gang of street toughs would beat the hell out of me. But bullying is out of control. There's no question about it. Maybe one of the reasons is we're not thinking about bullying the right way. That's what Charles Derber says. Derber's a sociology professor at Boston College. He's also the co-author, along with Yale McGrath, of a book called Bully Nation, How the American Establishment Creates a Bullying Society. Steve Paulson talked with Derber.
So this is not just a matter of personal psychology. I mean, you're bringing sociology in here. In fact, you cite the great sociologist C. Wright Mills, who had this idea of the sociological imagination.
Right. So Mills meant that in the United States, we tend to view all problems as personal, and they can be solved by dealing with the individual psychology and psychological aberrations or problems that manifest in individuals carrying out the behavior. Our argument is, and this is the argument of Mills, Mills said that private problems are public issues. And what he meant by that is that the psychology may be real, but it grows out of structural, institutional realities that define the way the larger society operates and out of institutions. So we think that large corporations, which are major institutions, are routinely bullying their workers and their competitors and their consumers. We think that large institutions like the military are, you know, deeply involved in institutional bullying in obvious ways. You know, bigger countries bully smaller countries with repeated threats of humiliating, insulting, attacking them if they don't comply with their wishes and recognize the authority of the more powerful country. And obviously, in military training, recruits starting from boot camp are subjected to rituals of humiliation and control, which kind of instill a psychology of, or a set of values or culture of bullying as sort of just part of military culture.
One of the kinds of structural bullying you talk about is what you call capital bullying. Can you explain what this is?
Yeah, it's really important because we live in a capitalist society, and that's just a play on the idea of capitalism. And this goes back to very basic ideas about how our economic system operates, which is that, one, it's a system in which most people do not have the resources, meaning land, money, whatever, to provide for themselves without selling them their services on the labor market. It's an employment at will system, meaning you have no security. I mean, you get hired and fired in a pretty random way. So the most obvious form of bullying that's sort of baked into our capitalist economic system is that most workers are vulnerable as contingent workers, temps, people who don't have much job security, people who can be fired, to this constant dread and anxiety that they have to be super careful not to alienate people with the authority to let them go, fire them, you know, reduce their pay and benefits and so forth. That structural reality is kind of part of the DNA of capitalism. It's always been true. There are two things that are making it worse today in some ways. One is globalization gives corporations greater exit power.
Meaning they can close down the shop, in this country
yes.
and go somewhere
yes.
abroad.
I mean, the whole globalization field, I believe that I've written other books on globalization and capitalism, and I believe globalization has been driven to a large measure in the United States by, leaders of corporate America who felt that over the New Deal era, which lasted, through much of the mid-20th century up to Reagan, workers had simply developed too much countervailing power through New Deal kinds of government support of labor and regulations and so forth. And they said, we can make a lot more money and get a lot more docile labor force if we essentially basically disinvest in the United States and create global markets for ourselves where we're not dependent, global labor markets, where we're not dependent on American workers as much.
So if bullying then is baked into the capitalist system, as you say, does that mean that countries that are maybe a little more socialist or at least, on the social welfare spectrum, Scandinavian countries like Denmark and Sweden, do they have less bullying?
Well, that's precisely the case. And if you look at European countries where, for at least through much of the 20th century, you had strong labor parties, you had countrywide unions, the power inequalities were much less. And we have some data. They're not great because they focus just on pretty much on kids and schoolyard bullying, but the lowest bullying rates do tend to be in exactly the countries you mentioned, Steve, that is in Scandinavian countries, particularly Sweden and so forth, where you have, in Sweden, 70% of the workforce is in unions as against the tiny percent in America today. And these unions are collectively organized so that it's sort of like one big AFL-CIO. There's one large union uniting blue-collar and white-collar workers. So there's a really strong collective way in which workers can speak, their mind and sort of assert a power against sort of abusive corporate authority.
So the question then is there anything we can do? Because you're saying that so many of these problems are structural. If we live in a society that has these big inequalities, and then we have certain people, maybe politicians, who play up those differences, what can we do?
The whole thrust of our book, that to adjust to a society driven by these power inequalities and the kind of violence and power abuse that we see in our larger culture, and that I think sort of accounts for the popularity of somebody like Trump. There's a lot of critique of him because of his bullying, just as there is anti-bullying culture in the schools and so forth, programs to try to reduce it. But he's gotten an enormous amount of popular support in certain segments of the population because those people have been exposed to all of these institutional, cultural, macro societal forces that, encourage these values and these behaviors. So the answer to your question, what do? You need to deal with creating social kind of movements and organizations that can contest the kind of extreme power inequality, the problem of inequality, and the problem of violence that has been normalized in our society and in our culture.
Charles Derber is the co-author, along with Yale McGrath, of Bully Nation: How the American Establishment Creates a Bullying Society. Derber spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, Julian Barnes' new novel, based on the life of the great Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about bullies, and you could make the case that the Soviet dictator Stalin was the ultimate bully. Stalin not only jailed and killed his enemies, he also terrorized Russians who weren't even involved in politics, like writers and artists. One of the most famous examples was the great Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. He spent much of his life worrying that the secret police would haul him off to the gulag or kill him. Shostakovich's life is now the subject of a new novel by the acclaimed English writer Julian Barnes. It's called The Noise of Time. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Barnes and asked him to read an excerpt from the book.
They always came for you in the middle of the night. And so, rather than be dragged from the apartment in his pajamas or forced to dress in front of some contemptuously impassive NKVD man, he would go to bed fully clothed, lying on top of the blankets, a small case already packed on the floor beside him. He barely slept and lay there imagining the worst things a man could imagine. One of his persistent waking nightmares was that the NKVD would seize Galia and pack her off, if she was lucky, to a special orphanage for children of enemies of the state, where she would be given a new name and a new character, where she would be turned into a model Soviet citizen, a little sunflower lifting her face towards the great sun that called itself Stalin.
Julian, your book opens in 1936, I think it is, when Shostakovich is terrified that he's going to be arrested and imprisoned. Why was he in such danger then?
Well, he was from the age of 19 when he wrote his first symphony, which was heard all over the world within a few months. He was the poster boy of music for the Russian Revolution. The trouble is, Stalin came along, and Stalin was interested in music and thought he knew what music was and should be. And composers were very closely watched. So what happened was that Stalin had heard about Shostakovich's very successful new opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsiansk, and decided that he and three high members of the Politburo would go to a performance at the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow. Shostakovich was hauled back from a concert tour he was on in northern Russia and attended this performance. And at the end of the third act, all of a sudden, the government box where Stalin was hidden behind a curtain, a small curtain, but where the other three members of the Politburo were well visible. All of a sudden, he noticed it was empty. They had not returned for the fourth act.
They didn't like
it. So he set off, Shostakovich set off for Arkhangelsk to return to his concert tour. And a couple of mornings later, he went to the railway station to buy his copy of Pravda, opened it, and there on page three was a famous denunciation headed Muddle Instead of Music, which wasn't just, you know, your bad music review of the sort you get in your local paper. This was denunciation from on high. And the final line of that editorial, it is a game of clever ingenuity that might end very badly. It still sends a chill through me, even at this distance of 8 years on. And that was the start of his troubles.
That ends very badly. I mean, that's almost a deliberate threat to the composer.
It is. And the next stage to that is to be called an enemy of the people.
So what didn't Stalin like about this opera?
Well, he didn't like the libretto. He didn't like the subject matter. He didn't like the sex. He didn't like the violence. And most of all, he didn't like the music.
So what did Stalin do to artists that he didn't like?
Well, if they were writers especially, they got shot or they got sent into exile. One of the advantages of being denounced on page three of Pravda, as the composers were, was that it didn't immediately mean you got sent to the labor camps in Siberia.
So there had been this devastating review in Pravda about this opera by Shostakovich. Why do you think he was spared?
It's an unanswerable question. Perhaps they recognized that Shostakovich was not only the greatest talent that they had, but also someone who was very capable of writing what they considered tuneful, graceful music. And Shostakovich didn't mind doing that. You know, he knew that Caesar had to be paid.
So what drew you to the story? I mean, why did you want to write a fictionalized version of Shostakovich's life?
Well, he's been with me for 50 or more years. When I was at school, when I was 16 or so, I read Russian, I studied Russian, and then I did it for two terms at university as well. And I'm a child of the Cold War, you know, born in 1946. And Shostakovich's music, which I first heard when I was 18 or so, was part of my understanding Russianness and Sovietness. And then in about 1979-80, Shostakovich's memoirs, as told to Solomon Volkov, a controversial book, but one which many who knew Shostakovich has said is truthful. That was published, and I realized that Shostakovich was not just a great composer, but also a fascinating case. I can't think of any composer in the history of Western music who, on a daily, monthly, lifelong basis, was so much under pressure from power. And furthermore, as a writer in the relatively free West, it makes you ask the question, well, what would you have done in the circumstances?
Right. Right. And what have you concluded in that? I mean, you must have thought about it. I mean, what if you were in that situation? If you were writing in the Soviet Union in the 1930s...
I would have been very careful, and I would have been probably what the West would have called cowardly.
Well, I have to ask you about a piece that you recently wrote in The Guardian, where, I mean, you talk about how Shostakovich was a coward, but it was impossible not to be a coward in his position. But you also say he's your hero.
Yes, I said my hero is a coward, or rather my hero is a man who considered himself a coward. He was a survivor. And managed to write wonderful music.
So here Shostakovich was in the mid-30s. He'd just been denounced by Pravda. Clearly Stalin did not approve of what he had done. I mean, you know, he was thinking he could be killed any minute. And then not long after that, he goes on to compose his Fifth Symphony, which is considered one of the masterpieces of 20th century music. It turned out to be a huge success at its premiere in Leningrad.
That's right. But the great controversy was about the final movement. It ends fortissimo and in the major after a great, thrilling, indeed hysterically thrilling, final movement. And I think Shostakovich knew what he was doing. He was giving them what seemed like a triumphant ending. On the other hand, it's kind of like a hysterical version of triumph. And it is. It's irony. It's Shostakovich's irony. He said of it himself, the last movement is like a man beating you over the head and shouting, rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. So it's a hollow and mocking version of a triumphant end to a piece of music.
But the Soviet authorities did not pick up on that.
No. I mean, that's one of the advantages of irony, that irony is something that a tyrant rarely recognizes.
Now, later on, I mean, after the Fifth Symphony, there's another episode, a truly awful one, where Shostakovich leads an official delegation to the U.S., and he's required to read a speech denouncing his artistic hero, Stravinsky. How did that play out?
He subsequently said, this was the worst moment of my life. I mean, he had a lot of bad moments in his life, but this was really bad. He revered Stravinsky. He said, without any shadow of doubt, Stravinsky was the greatest composer of the 20th century. But he was sent in 1949 to the Peace Congress in New York, at which he was an official Soviet delegate. And then, to his horror, after giving his speech, he was then interrogated from the floor by Nicholas Nabokov, cousin of the novelist, who asked him a series of questions of, you know, what do you yourself think? Which was, of course, impossible for Shostakovich to answer. And it was a public shaming for him. And his life, as it went on, even though it became in some ways easier, it became materially easier, and after the death of Stalin, there was very little chance of him being taken away. His life, in a funny way, became darker because, you know, the most dangerous times are not necessarily the times when you're most in danger.
Yeah. He ended up living a long time. He died in 1975. He was very famous around the world.
Yes.
But do you consider this a tragic life?
I do, actually. I think it's a life of a man who was a brilliant composer, but who was kind of spiritually broken by the regime. He lost his soul eventually. I think this is how he would see it himself.
Now, this is a story, among other things, about legacy, about the legacy of this man, Shostakovich, and also about his art. And, I mean, artists die, but for a few, their art lives on for generations. And you have a passage at the very end of your book that gets at this, and I'm wondering if you could read that.
Yes, this is almost the exact conclusion of the novel. What he hoped for was that death would liberate his music, liberate it from his life. Time would pass, and though musicologists would continue their debates, his work would begin to stand for itself. History, as well as biography, would fade. Perhaps one day fascism and communism would merely be words in textbooks. And then, if it still had value, if there were still ears to hear, his music would be just music. That was all a composer could hope for. Whom does music belong to? He had asked that trembling student, and though the reply was written in capital letters on a banner behind her interrogator's head, the girl could not answer. Not being able to answer was the correct answer, because music, in the end, belonged to music. That was all you could say or wish for.
That's Julian Barnes reading from his novel, The Noise of Time. He spoke with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Our staff includes Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music. Thanks to Kirill Owen for her excellent engineering. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Gordon, sitting in for Anne Strangehamps. Thanks for listening.
Public Radio International.